You've got enough on your plate. Mundane meals shouldn't be one of them. Get an endless variety of the freshest, best-tasting food from award-winning chefs delivered to your door with Cook Unity, all at a fraction of the cost and time you're spending now. Take a load off and leave your meal prep to Cook Unity. Affordable food crafted by award-winning chefs delivered straight to your door. Go to cookunity.com/podcast or enter code podcast before checkout for 50% off your first week.
Into sports.
20 yards out. Urs to shoot. Don't shoot. Oh, what a goal for Fabinho. Wow.
And get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap?
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power.
Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Another Champions League evening. We have Leipzig-Liverpool. We have PSG against Barcelona. Philippe Auclair, evening.
Good evening to you.
So last night was decent fare, certainly in the drama stakes when Wojciech Szczesny made a mess of that free kick. I don't think a football fan alive didn't scream something.
Well, did I scream?
You did. You said, oh my God.
Something, words to that effect. That's the way you would say it.
Yes. Extraordinary evening, and that's Ronaldo and Juve once again bowing out.
Well, yes, I mean, which is a huge blow for them, obviously. And you've got to ask yourself questions about the kind of strategy that Juve have had over the past couple of seasons, past three seasons, because to be honest, for them, getting to the final of the Champions League and winning it this time was the Holy Grail. And they, I know it's probably unfair to say such a thing, but they decided to commit an awful lot of resources to the recruitment and the salary of one Cristiano Ronaldo. And I'm not absolutely sure it was the right choice to make at the time. And you wonder if they're not paying a bit for the decision, because obviously it had a ripple effect on the rest of the recruitment and as well as on the balance of the team and on relying on somebody who is still a magnificent match winner on his day, but who is also not somebody perhaps who participates in the team effort as he used to. And he never used to do very much of that, but he does even less of it now. So I think quite a few people saw it coming, but perhaps not in that particular way. I must say that it was a little bit crazy last night.
It was. To matters at hand, PSG are 4-1 up on Barcelona at the Parc des Princes, so you would presume they'll safely navigate this one. That being said, there are interesting aspects to what we're about to watch. The first leg was dominated by Mbappe terrorising Barcelona and Erst Haaland responding 24 hours later. Here we are for the second leg, and Haaland has hit 20 Champions League goals in 14 matches, in doing so destroying Harry Kane's record by 10 games. So it's over to you, Killian.
Well, the form is in at the moment. I don't know if you saw what he did at the weekend in the Coupe de France and the French Cup. Obviously, not quite the same level of competition, not quite the same kind of level of opposition. But it was rather spectacular. He's been unleashed, basically. And his first goal in particular was a thing of absolute beauty. I think Verratti managed to intercept the ball near the halfway line. And Mbappe just ran to the goal. And after, you know, fading this way, fading that way, setting a couple of false clues to the defender, suddenly lined up this absolutely amazing left-footed shot, which ended up in the corner of the net, and it was absolutely unstoppable. And he's been like this. I mean, basically, that is the biggest news for PSG, is that Kylian Mbappe is back to this kind of level, and he's really showing at the moment why, you know, people, you know, you talk about Haaland, I talk about Mbappe. Some people will talk about Phil Foden, I'm sure, not too long. But he is really very, very special. He's in great form. And for Pochettino, I mean, he's got a fairly full squad to choose from, with the exception of Neymar, who some people thought might be able to do it to make it to the bench, but that's apparently not the case. He's got a problem with the adductors, and he's not in a fit state to play. But what they've got on the pitch tonight should be enough, to be honest. I mean, it would be that's perhaps the only thing that makes me wonder about it is that should it happen, it would probably be even worse than what happened in March 2017, when they gave away three goals in 7 minutes from the 88th minute onwards and lost the famous remontada and were kicked out of the Champions League. I really can't see this happening tonight. I mean, honestly, they're a different team. They look more solid. And also, there are only a few players today in that PSG lineup who will remember what happened on that night and will bear the scars of this terrible disappointment. So, honestly, I think they should be able to make that. And I would say quite easily. Yes. Famous last words, eh?
Well, it's a very different PSG, as you've said. It's also radically
different Barcelona.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Dramatically. So I was reading a few pieces on Pochettino and how he's settling in. So I hadn't realised he'd contracted COVID early on. I vaguely remembered it, and then I was reading today, and I thought, yes, of course, that was a tricky start. And his family
his
have remained
staff as well. Yeah,
his all his staff. Yeah, his family have remained in England. His son has signed for Watford, which was interesting. But I also saw he's not speaking French in the media. He speaks in Spanish or he speaks in English. A bit like when he was at Southampton, he declined to speak in English. So he's holding off on the French just yet. I presume this is just some kind of tactic. It allows him kind of mumble through explanations when he wants.
No, because he's flanked by Miguel D'Agostino, who speaks very, very good French indeed, and who is a very good translator, even though he's not. It's not his job. I think it's more a question that he wants to be on top of his communication, as we say in French, sa communication, and that he's afraid that if he speaks in French, which he can speak and quite well, by the way, but it's a little bit rusty. He would be misunderstood, and given the degree of focus that is directed at PSG and on him in particular, you can understand why he wants to be very, very careful and very cautious. And I'm sure that he will have been encouraged by the people at the club to be careful precisely. But there's the other problem is that he wanted to have refresher courses in French. And that because of the situation, because of the COVID situation, he hasn't been able to do so. So he's rustier than he thought he would have been at this stage of his stay in Paris. It's only a question of time. But it certainly is. I think people are looking at it and they know what happened when he was in England. You say Southampton, but I seem to remember the first press conferences I went to when he was at Tottenham, he was still speaking Spanish.
Right.
And so it took him quite a long time to get to that level.
Yeah.
But don't forget, of course, he played for PSG. He has experience of speaking French. French should be an easier language for him than English, by the way, being a Latino-Romance language. So, but it has been noticed, but it's not really something that is held against him very much at the moment.
Okay. I was reading Guillaume Balaguer was writing on the BBC website, and he was saying it's his understanding that Pochettino has, quote, put a metaphorical arm around the shoulder of those players who struggled with the distance Tuchel liked to keep with players. Now, we're seeing Tuchel at first hand at Chelsea, and I can imagine him keeping players at a distance, and it's a strict enough regime in many ways. So is Pochettino more of an arm around the shoulder type? Is that what you're hearing?
Yes, that's what I'm hearing at the moment. Even though I would perhaps beg to differ in the differentiating the managers in such stark terms, Tuchel can also be a manager who he has a different type of relationship. Pochettino is very much more of a arm around the shoulder, very simpatico, very human in his relationship. Perhaps not quite as cutting as Tuchel can be at times. But he's also a very strict disciplinarian. I think one of the things that people have appreciated in Paris is the way that he's been able to approach the squad with a completely clean slate kind of approach. So he hasn't let any preconceptions you know, rule his decisions or taint his judgment of, and he's given some chances to players like Moise Kean, was unfortunately not available tonight because he's actually he was tested positive. He tested positive for COVID last week, but he's given chances to players that perhaps were not expecting it. He's been he's been perhaps more open-minded than some people feared, and I guess following the extreme tension of the last few weeks and months of Tuchel's tenure, I guess that having somebody like Mauricio Pochettino, who is such a warm and humane kind of man, made a big difference and certainly lightened up the atmosphere quite a bit in the dressing room. But I think we're making a little bit too much perhaps of the differences between the characters of the two coaches, because what people say about Tuchel at Chelsea, what I'm hearing about Tuchel at Chelsea is that actually people have been surprised that he was actually quite approachable and actually enjoyed the relationship he had with his players, and was very much was not quite the distant, hands-off, incredibly technical, incredibly tactical kind of manager that perhaps he's been presented like.
Okay. I mean, ultimately, Tuchel's problem, amongst other issues, I'm sure, was that discipline was difficult to impose, not least when it came to Neymar, because Neymar had a direct line to the owner of the club, and you know, the owner of the club liked being friends with Neymar, and Neymar liked having birthday parties, which went on for 48 hours. And where does that leave?
Oh, longer than that.
Or longer than, his 6 months, his half birthdays went on for 48 hours. where does that leave you if you're Tuchel? It leaves you hamstrung. So I'm wondering how Pochettino navigates that dynamic, or maybe that hasn't arisen yet.
I don't think it has arisen yet, and one of the reasons why it hasn't arisen yet is because Neymar is injured, and so this is a problem, if that is a problem, that he will have to address later. I think as well he arrived perhaps with a different reputation, as in when Tuchel came in, Tuchel was, how can I put that, perhaps it was a kind of graft that people were not expecting, and it seemed a little bit against nature, if you see what I mean. Whereas Pochettino, completely different context. Pochettino is somebody who was PSG. He was a player, and he was not just a player. He was a player that I remember Luis Fernandez saying when he was his manager, if I had 11 players like Mauricio Pochettino, I would win everything. That's the kind of reputation and aura he had at the club and with the supporters. And that matters. Tuchel is nothing of the kind. Tuchel arrived with a reputation of somebody who was quite difficult, whose relationship with his previous clubs had ended quite bitterly, and who was very much kind of a new wave of technicians, managers, coaches, whichever way you wanted to. Whereas Pochettino is still the Bielsa disciple and all these sort of things, but he's also a kind of more traditional kind of manager, should I say that? Mm-hmm. And perhaps he was, when he came to PSG as well, Pochettino had been courted by PSG for quite a while. It was the culmination of a process which took quite a while. Tuchel was different. Tuchel arrived at a different phase of the club's development, at a different crisis state, because it's always a crisis state at PSG. And perhaps because of that, this tainted the perception that we had of his tenure and the way he was perceived by the players and the way he related to, you know, Neymar and so forth. Because honestly, what I've heard about Tuchel and from people who are very close to the club, much closer than I am, who follow it day to day, is that an awful lot has been made about the relationship that he had with some of his star players and has been blown out of all proportion. Okay. And that actually, up until quite late in his reign at Paris Saint-Germain, things were going on well. In particular, Neymar had completely taken on the mantle of being a leader in the dressing room. He was talking to the young players a lot. He was trying to help them. And I totally believe that. You know, the image of Neymar being just this party animal, which is, you know, goes to Rio as soon as Sao Paulo, any time he can do it, and that's about it. That's his commitment to football, is wrong. That's totally wrong. If you have watched Paris Saint-Germain with Neymar, you will see that he's always been so very, very committed to the cause. Perhaps he hasn't had the kind of hygiene in his, as we say in French, or lifestyle, to be more correct, that he should have had. But I think we've overblown that a little bit.
Okay. And in fairness to him, he was very, very good in the knockout stages last season. Yeah. So, look, ultimately approaches will change and the club will be at a different stage to where it was a year ago and certainly 3 or 4 years ago. When it all boils down to it, Philippe, you're watching PSG more regularly than all of us, I suspect. Is there any great difference in terms of what PSG are doing on the field now under Pochettino? Early days, I know, but what they're doing now under Pochettino and what they were doing towards the end of last year under Tuchel?
Yeah, I think the balance is much, much better. It's a bit of a funny team because, you know, you've got players of very, I would say, different levels who coexist, who are playing together in this team. And some of them are like superstars and super players. Some of them are good international players. Some of them are okay, good, but not fantastic. But there is a balance now. And the big difference that Pochettino has made is that is the way he's looked at his midfield and the way he's restructured it. And now you've got basically Leandro Paredes, who is there all the time and who is a complete revelation when you think of where his career was going when he went to Russia. And you've got Ganagay. Those two guys are absolutely central. They're the double pivot, with Paredes being more of a playing, deep-lying midfielder, which has enabled Marco Verratti to go up one, one level. And I mean in terms of the space. He's gone up and he's now playing as a number 10. And he's reveling in that. And you're seeing the proper Verratti. So it has been it's not a small change. It's actually a very big change,
right,
in tactical terms. And this has paid dividends. And of course, it means that you've got now this place, is number 10, is taken by Verratti, which means it's going to be a bit of a problem when Neymar comes back, because you're going to have to find room for everybody else. You know, Draxler is very good at the moment. Icardi has been great. Kylian Mbappe is simply unstoppable. So you've got Neymar, you've got Di Maria, you can carry on Sarabia. It's going to be interesting to see. But at the moment, yes, he's done that. He's given the team a balance it didn't have before with Tuchel. He's found within the squad the means to do that.
Okay, very interesting. Well, listen, we're suspecting there won't be a shock in that game. If we're going to see a shock, it'll probably be in Budapest. The Liverpool thing is just continuing to defy logic. I mean, collapse isn't even the word anymore. It's the most extraordinary, for want of a better word, collapse, capitulation I can remember seeing in football.
I was talking today with my foreign desk editor at France Football, and we were trying to find examples, not just in England, but in world football, of a team that, after becoming, you know, the best team in its era, which it has been for the last 2.5 years, you know, champion of England, champion of Europe, champion of the world, final, as well as a Europa League final and another Champions League final. And thinking, are there any other examples of a team that reaches such incredible summits and then collapses this way? And we couldn't. I genuinely, we couldn't. In any case, you know, even teams that had most of their star players taken away from them because they had just won, you know, a Champions League, and they were like an Ajax, for example, or a Porto, and they didn't have the means to keep them. There was a dip, or sometimes a very severe dip, turbulences, but never this kind of collapse. Sometimes you can think, like, it can happen if you think of what happened to Antonio Conte's Chelsea after they won the title. Perhaps you would think, that was pretty bad. But it was nothing compared to what we're seeing now. And even it has nothing to do with what happened with Borussia Dortmund in 2015, which is an example which has been taken on by many people. But remember that at one point, I think they were above the relegation zone. But they kicked on from Christmas onwards and they finished seventh that season. So they were able to react. You do get the feeling with that Liverpool team that the reaction is, you won't get it. It's very sad.
Philippe, always great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
You're welcome along. Second half's just getting started in the Champions League games. It's nil all still between Liverpool and Leipzig. 2-0, of course, to Liverpool on aggregate, I'm sure you know by now. Best of the chances in the first half all went the way of Liverpool. Thiago with a beautiful assist. Well, it would have been an assist if Salah had finished, but a beautiful assist for Salah. The ball was bouncing high up in midfield and Thiago karate kicked it over the top for Salah to run onto. He was at a bit of an angle, Salah, but still just went straight at the keeper, didn't quite go near post or far post. And then the keeper saved it and Mane came rushing on to the rebound and just headed it straight into the ground as opposed to towards the goal. That's the way Mane's life is going at the moment. Jota had two other chances, both pretty good chances, you'd have to say. One from the edge of the area, one from a bit of an angle as well. And then a couple of other half chances besides. And that's been Liverpool's lot. For Leipzig, they haven't done much at all. They haven't taken the game to Liverpool. Liverpool have been on top. They had one decent chance pulled just wide, but that's where we are. Liverpool will be happy with the dominance and the performance, but of course the nagging sense remains that they're still one Leipzig goal away from serious jitters. As for events in Paris, PSG are very comfortable. It's 5-2 in aggregate, which means it's 1-1 on the night. Mbappe scored a penalty to open the exchange. And then Messi with a wonder goal. It's beautiful stuff. You'll get a look at it on Twitter or somewhere else, I'm sure. It's a proper 30 yards out strike. I'm not over exaggerating. He's way out the pitch. He has no right to shoot and he just rifles it and he kind of cuts his left foot across the ball. So the ball swerves from right to left and goes into the top corner, but it is traveling. He then confirmed he is human by missing a penalty. So that would be a regret for Barcelona. 5-2 on aggregate at PSG, you would think very safely through. So Miguel Delaney was with us earlier on. Juventus's wait for a third Champions League crown goes on. Now 25 years since they beat Dortmund in those blue jerseys, if you're a certain vintage you'll remember, with Viali and Del Piero and Ravanelli and Deschamps and Conte and that whole team. So crashed out last night to Porto in dramatic fashion. And earlier on, we spoke with Miguel Delaney of the London Independent.
Evening.
Porto, extra time. I mean, there was unbelievable tension and drama about this. The feed I was watching had no crowd noise. And so, whereas often that means a very quiet stadium, this was the opposite. This was high stakes. There were loads of individuals just shouting, screaming. It was a kind of scattergun type atmosphere as opposed to the more smoother hum of recorded masses. And it just heightened the whole experience in a perverse way. I never thought that an empty stadium with maybe 100 people in it could be so tense.
Well, I suppose that's the thing as well. You could feel the real tension, anxiety that all the players and staff were feeling. And I have to say as well, it did feel the first really kind of proper European game in that sense that we've arguably had in this whole situation. I mean, let's not overlook it. I mean, the Champions League, the blitz that took place in Lisbon last summer was really good. Had some great games, but there was still an element of abnormality about it because it was such a new situation. Whereas this did feel more like, just apart from the crowd, it did feel more like a classic European tie of the kind we've become accustomed to over the last half decade. And I was wondering in the build-up to this game, and did a piece about it, especially given there were so many away wins and we have situations where some teams are going to require comebacks, whether the drama we've associated with the Champions League of the past few years will be quite as possible without crowds, especially given everyone seems to have got used to the new situation. It's not really that new anymore. But this proved that it can be the case and that, the football alone will be enough. It was a remarkable match.
It was. I only caught extra time, so I didn't get to see the 90s. But my sense of extra time, obviously, was that it was very tense. And there was kind of an angry atmosphere in the air. This was tetchy.
Yeah, totally. Well, I suppose there was so much on the line in that regard, especially for Juve. And just what it means for the club and everything around the grand project of Ronaldo. And like, I have to say, given there's been such a relentless slog of Premier League over the past few months, first of all, just to watch a European game like this was welcome and different. But also, just because of the different nature of it, but also, in its own way, that kind of classic European, how to put it, you know, again, gamesmanship, that, you know, the kind of the nagging at referees, or trying to influence everything, which is still, I mean, it's not like England doesn't see this, but you still see it to a much greater level in continental football. And, you know, that added to the drama, I think, and something we've been missing.
You wrote in the London Independent that Juve are a dysfunctional, bloated mess, and there was a degree of poetic justice about their exit last night. So expand on that for us.
Well, the poetic justice, I suppose, is more down to the fact that Agnelli, the Juve owner and president, has been at the forefront of the move to try and reform the Champions League. Now, I think there's considerable debate as to whether he's actually driving that, given it seems to be, and from what you hear around the game, is that he's almost the useful foghorn for other people. He will say what others won't, and he'll, like, all these mad suggestions he has will just reposition the debate to, you know, so the big clubs get what they really want. But it still can't be separated from the fact some of these are really undesirable ideas, like stuff like how the last 15 minutes of games could be subscription, or how Champions League clubs mightn't be able to trade with each other, that they might just buy off non-Champions League clubs. There's all manner of these suggestions, which are ultimately about protecting the status and the kind of the platform of all these legacy clubs. And there's a real air of self-entitlement to it, which is why, yeah, there is, I think, a real poetic justice when Porto, there's always scales of this. Porto are almost like, Porto are the Juventus of Italy in that regard. They kind of they run the rule there. But even still, Porto are precisely one of the clubs that Europe's super clubs would like to shut out. So yeah, it did feel there was a real kind of moral justice to them just totally upending these notions that people like Agnelli have, and, you know, shoving it back for them. There was a kind of a self-righteousness to the victory.
How are we to view the Ronaldo project then?
Well, I mean, you only have to look, I suppose, the basic results. Juventus were a club that were so close to the Champions League in the years before he signed. Got to the final in 2015, you know, gave Barca a good game. Got to the final in 2017, gave Madrid a good game, at least for a half, before Ronaldo himself pulled away. And that was Ronaldo's fourth of five Champions Leagues, making him the most successful player in the competition's modern history since the European Cup became the Champions League. So it was almost like Juve were operating off this simplistic logic that we're that close, we'll just sign the competition's greatest scorer and he'll take us all the way. But it's totally backfired, and far from getting to finals, they've actually receded. They've been getting eliminated earlier and earlier. That's two last 16 eliminations in a row. But also, it's not just that. It's not like they're getting knocked out by Barca or Madrid or any of the super clubs anymore. They've been getting knocked out by Lyon, Ajax and Porto, which, I mean, for, again, the notions that Juve have of themselves is quite a landing, and also in its own way hilarious. And this is connected to what they've tried to do, Ronaldo, because there is a bit of a dilemma here. I mean, I described Juve as a dysfunctional, bloated mess in that piece. And that's true because they've got so many players. I mean, Ronaldo basically personifies a wider problem that they have, which is a lot of players, particularly players in the late 20s or beyond, on massive contracts that were agreed on the pre-COVID world and are going to have to be probably quite drastically renegotiated over the next year or two. But it's also come where Juve are trying to bring in a new identity. That was the rationale behind appointing Maurizio Sarri and then appointing Andrea Pirlo. They want a modern way of playing, which is, you know, progressive, proactive, lots of pressing, fluid. But the issue is, you can't really play that kind of modern game with the current Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, I said last, he's almost like a siege weapon at this point because his mobility is so limited. It's almost like he has to be moved into a certain position with a ball launched at him for him to be as devastating as we know he can be. And that's not to diminish his greatness. Mm. It's just the reality of what he is as a 36-year-old. So while Ronaldo's in the team, and he is always going to be in the team when they're paying that much money, they can't really introduce this new identity they want. And it's going to create this dilemma. And that could be seen at all stages of this tie where, you know, on one hand, they're trying to introduce playing out from the back, but it backfires spectacularly, as happened in the opening minutes of the tie in the first leg. And it's just something that doesn't quite work about the team, to the point where their only real recourse to going behind the Porto was just launching balls into the box in fairly basic fashion. It was just that Cuadrado was very good with it. But that's what I mean by being dysfunctional. I mean, the best clubs, when Liverpool have been at their best, or when Manchester City have been at their best, or Bayern Munich at their best over the past few years, everything at the club is working in unison. And Liverpool have probably been the best example of that until this season. At Juventus right now, there are loads of parts that aren't working in unison, and one of the biggest is Ronaldo.
It's a very interesting conversation, because you look at the stats then, and Ronaldo could really argue that he has largely held up his end of the bargain. 29 goals in 37 this year. Last year it was 48 goals in 52, including two against Lyon. There are only two against Lyon. The year before that, 31 in 47, and he scored a goal in each leg against Ajax. You know, we're talking Ajax, Lyon, and okay, he didn't perform quite the same way against Porto. He's won two Serie A's, two Supercoppas, 92 goals in 121, all in. Like, the terms of failure and success don't really apply here. They're too basic. It would seem he hasn't arrived and coasted by any means, but maybe that they're not mutually exclusive points, that he has actually done okay in the manner in which he can do okay at this age, and Juventus have still morphed into something not quite as effective as they were under Allegri.
Yeah, I think what his stats do and what his relative success show, and again, those incredible goal figures show, is the dilemma posed by his signing. And it's interesting how things have actually come full circle there, because there was a similar debate about Ruud van Nistelrooy just before he left Man United, where the argument was that because of the striker Van Nistelrooy was at that point in his career, United needed to play a certain way, and it meant that Van Nistelrooy would guarantee goals, but it made United quite predictable. So while he would score, it would actually mitigate their chances of going to the next level. And the next level actually involved players of the fluidity and mobility of Rooney and Ronaldo roaming around, which is basically what happened once they got rid of Van Nistelrooy and Ferguson allowed that. And it feels like we're at a similar point with Juventus and Ronaldo now, where if you play a specific way, he will guarantee goals, but it's not necessarily the best practice. That approach and those guarantee of goals aren't actually guarantee of victory in the same way anymore. And it actually makes, you know, it will give Juve goals, but it also will in turn almost make them more vulnerable and easy to play against.
Yes, there's a ceiling. In a way, it was a very unnuanced signing, you know, as you said.
Yeah, that's why I kind of made the point about it was if they just, you know, they saw they were close to the Champions League, got the top score, and it did feel as crude as that or as simplistic as that. Mm. Let us bolt on this brilliant score and we'll obviously go to the next level. But that hasn't happened.
It's hard not to feel as well that this is all, that, you know, the last couple of years have been part of football clubs increasingly seeing themselves as bastions of entertainment. And we had James Horncastle on when Pirlo was announced, and he absolutely felt that the part of the decision-making was to do with the fact that this is an amazing story and Pirlo's coming back and, you know, social media presence has exploded since they signed Ronaldo. And you've got to think that did factor into their thinking a little bit. Like, to be a modern super club, there has to be a story there, an intrigue there as well. Like, as ludicrous as it sounds, and, you know, John Giles, who's a regular on this show, just would be shaking his head in dismay. But James kind of said that, look, that is part of the thinking here. And Pirlo coming in after these five great years of Allegri, four doubles in a row, the two Champions League finals, outstanding. To go from that, and look, Sarri, there was a logic, I suppose, to go with Sarri, but to go from that to Pirlo, given the age profile of the team, like, in hindsight now, you think, well, geez, what were they thinking? I mean, it couldn't but go wrong.
Oh, yeah, totally. And actually, just on, I was having an interesting conversation this week with someone in football on exactly these lines. Just on Sunday night there, I was watching that film, The Founder, which is about the
McDonald's.
About Ray Kroc, who, of course, didn't found McDonald's, but basically took the idea on and made it into the business they were. But there's a key line in that film, which is seen as key to the history of McDonald's, where there was the realization that they weren't a fast food company. They were a real estate company, and it totally transformed their business profile. And there's been a bit of that with the super clubs over the past 10 to 15 years, in which they don't solely see themselves as football provider, as football clubs. They see themselves as content producers. Mm. That's what all the football is. And this goes back to Madrid in the mid-2000s, where they were arguing that their competitors were actually Disney. And this is how Juve see themselves, like, right? It's about creating that, seizing the attention in that way. And that's what Ronaldo has done. It's why, on some terms, he has been a success in improving their international profile. But what sums it up is, I suppose, I mean, a lot of people would have noticed watching the game last night that Juve's kit, it's not classic black and white stripes. They're kind of these black fades and the back is white. And apparently that's the theory, and what, you know, some people in Italy have said is that's because the traditional Juve black and white stripes, which I think is one of the greatest things about the club and really part of their allure and their aura, but they're seen as too close to American umpires for the United States market. And that and that could potentially mitigate against, you know, shirt sales in in a way that doesn't happen for Barca or Real Madrid. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about.
I'm going to get Nathan to put that to John Giles actually tomorrow and see what he has to say back. You're not wrong, because I remember being at the Web Summit a couple of years ago and there was a Manchester United suit there. I'm not sure, I can't remember his name, but he was
that was Arnold, Richard Arnold, wasn't
Yeah, and he was talking in these terms, and it was the first time I'd heard somebody talking so openly about, you know, how the projections for the social media presence and the content was every bit as to the fore of their thinking as what centre half do we need to sign? Like every bit, like a real marker for how they judge themselves, you know, and he had all the stats and all the projections and here's where we're going to go. So it's definitely this weird aspect now. You mentioned Ronaldo as a guaranteer of goals, which brings us to Haaland. So it is just kind of off the chart stuff at the moment, his pedigree this young. He's hit 20 Champions League goals now in 14 games. So that means he smashes Harry Kane's record by 10 games. You know, this is outrageous stuff, you know, and this is a record that stands in the Messi era, in the Ronaldo era. I was saying on the show last night, we had thought this guy would be at Dortmund for a couple of years. You know, the schedule was go there, develop 2-3 years, 4 years maybe, and then join a super club. He's blown that to smithereens. I mean, it's the clause, depending who you read, is somewhere in the region of 100 million euro, which, if you're going to get 10 years out of Haaland at a super club, is a bargain. So who's going to swoop in and get this guy? And I presume it will be this summer, COVID notwithstanding.
Well, I was talking to a few people about this today and in the last week, I suppose, because he's been so good. And City, as we know, want a number nine in the summer. That's their main priority. They do want Haaland. But from what I've been told from, you know, people close to him, from his camp, from a kind of a lot of Norwegian journalists, is that his current priority is, what the thinking is, and it's both due to his brother, who had to bow out of the game early due to injuries, and because Haaland himself suffers a lot of kind of little muscular injuries at this stage of his development. But apparently they don't want to, or their preference would be to not go to England yet, because the English league is seen as the most intense in Europe, and so relentless. So it might be better for the longevity of his career, because they are really planning a career well into the mid to late 30s here, like Ronaldo. So it might be better for him to go to Spain, preferably Madrid or Barcelona. But there is a potential dilemma there, because Madrid and Barcelona, as we know from so many developments over the past few weeks, they're really struggling for funds right now. And it's possible they won't be able to, for the next few years, won't be able to make the kind of Galactico signings they become accustomed to, which is why they might be dependent on any clause. And it does maybe create a little more uncertainty about this. Because with that in mind, from what I was told today, the preference is they might stay in a Borussia Dortmund for another year, but that is almost entirely dependent on whether Dortmund make the Champions League next season. Because, you know, for Haaland and for Mino Raiola, his agent, and for the entire plan, a player of his profile just can't be in the Europa League. He has to be in the top competition. So if Dortmund don't make the Champions League, that could change a few things in the summer. And that could allow the opening for City to come in. City apparently have about 3 or 4 strikers on their shortlist right now, and they're all under the age of 23, because they want full value out of whoever they sign. I suppose that's a sign of how the market itself is changing. I can remember situations in the early 2000s when Christian Vieri was going for record fees at the age of 29, 30. Now everyone's going to realise the lack of business logic in that. And Haaland represents a real business logic.
He sure does. He's just outrageous. He was talking after the game last night about the penalty, and where he shouted in Bono's face. And so he said, "I missed the penalty and then he cheated. So I took it again and I scored and he didn't cheat." When he was screaming in my face after the first one, I was thinking, it's going to be even better to score another goal. And that's what happened. So it was nice. When he was asked what he said to Bono, the goalkeeper, he said, "I don't want to say, I don't know what it means, but I said what he said to me after I missed the first one. It's karma. This man's an assassin.
Oh, yeah. He's got an attitude as well.
Big time.
I mean, I know a lot of people found the Messi-Ronaldo thing so tedious over the years and kind of the rivalry. But it's interesting that even Haaland seems to be fostering that with, like, even the way he conspicuously mentions that Mbappe's hat-trick against Barcelona drove him to do more 3 weeks ago. You know, there's an edge there. You know, a lot has been made about how he doesn't say that much in kind of post-match interviews and all the rest of it. But he says enough to kind of to boost that profile.
One last point, just to get your thoughts on briefly, and I'll let you go. Manchester United have appointed a football director at last, John Murta, who's been at the club since 2013. He's going to oversee operations, the men's, women's teams, academy, transfer strategy as well. And Darren Fletcher has been made technical director, where he'll have input into all football and performance areas, is what we're reading. Solskjaer, by all accounts, still has a veto over potential signings, I was reading, which is interesting. But what are we to make of this? I mean, one of my thoughts was for Ed Woodward is, like, if the time comes where a sacrificial lamb is needed, then he's got one. But that's probably a bit too cynical. I'm sure John Murta plans to be there a long time. This had been an ongoing saga for a good few years, and you'd Rio Ferdinand and others saying, why have they not got a director? Gary Neville was, you know, vociferous on how the club was flip-flopping in philosophical approach with its different managers. And it seemed to kind of die away since Solskjaer arrived, and now here we are, they have one.
Yeah, I mean, this process, I think the first reports of the search for a director of football came in the summer of 2018, around August, when there was a lot of uncertainty about Jose Mourinho. And it was at least one reason why there was tension between United and Mourinho. But it's funny, when that news came out today, someone in the game texted me basically saying, it's curious how, like, I mean, this is a joke, it should be said. It's curious how after 2.5 year search, the best in the world were actually already at the club. But I suppose the significance of that is really that it's no great change. It's just it's kind of formalization of a few roles, a few tweaks here and there, rather than any great change of structure at the club. And I suppose it's an endorsement of the current model and business as usual, and how much stock they've placed in Solskjaer as well. Woodward very much believes this is the right current model and that it will work. I suppose results over time will bear that out.
They're still just an odd team. Like, if you take the last month, culminating in the Etihad, they're just an odd team. It's crazily inconsistent.
But even that, I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but that was almost a consistency to them, because going by the last 2 years, I don't think anyone really should be surprised now that they went and won at the Etihad after a recent drop-off. That's just been the way of things with Solskjaer. It feels like every time they're on one of these streaks, and they are the ultimate streaky team, where they go on these incredible runs, it looks like everything is possible, only to immediately followed by one of these kind of just tedious drop-offs, only for Solskjaer to rescue it just to the point when it looks like something's going to get very bad. And like Sam Wallace did an excellent column in the Telegraph on Sunday, where he made the point, this is arguably the most insidious form of failure, because it gives United the illusion of being competitive, but yet really it's actually kind of a kind of purgatory for them, in that things are never going to get bad enough for them to make a change. And right now it just feels like, even though Solskjaer I think has a lot more qualities than a lot of people, myself included, would have given him credit for over the past 2 years, it's just never going to be quite good enough to maximise a club's resources in the way they should. And that's important for the future of the game, I think, because with the direction things are going and so many of the discussions we've had on the show, I think we could have a football world very soon that is, just because of the effects of the pandemic, because of the way it's going, because of, you know, state purchase, all the rest of it, where Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City are on another level financially to everyone else. They can pay wages no one else can. Mm. We're already seeing the effects of that on the big Spanish two. And it's possible that Chelsea and Manchester United are basically among the two clubs that can actually challenge them and make things interesting. But as it stands, even though United have made progress, they don't seem as sophisticated a football structure as City. But let's see how Woodward's decision today pans out.
Yeah, you developed that team in a very interesting piece that you wrote for the London Independent. People should check it out. It's on the website. In effect, how Neymar's transfer changed football, essentially, and how PSG saw the next cycle, and that's why they were so desperate to get Neymar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, from what I've repeatedly been told, the rationale behind that transfer went way beyond just signing one of the game's biggest stars and a coup and all the rest of it. It was basically because PSG knew, rather the Qatari owners knew, that if they drove up fees and wages to a certain level, there's only a handful of clubs that can compete. And that's basically Manchester City, who are, you know, Abu Dhabi backed, Manchester United, who remain the kind of the biggest money making machine in football, and Chelsea. And there was an extra calculation to what I was told, which was basically the idea that clubs like Barcelona and Real Madrid could go close to bankrupting themselves trying to keep up. And that is pretty much what's happened. Mm. And that's why I think it is quite ominous for football. I mean, we were talking about Juventus and how the kind of this schadenfreude and them getting their face rubbed into it. And I think the situation in football over the last decade has been suboptimal, where there's a gang of super clubs or a group of super clubs who the ones that have been naturally leading the charge for a Super League, but they're dominating the domestic leagues and it's not healthy. But this next development, I think, is even worse because it makes the top level of the game even narrower. And, like, I mean, football is at its best when there's a healthy competitive balance. I mean, that was the case of the late 90s when you could have suddenly, you know, teams like Nantes or Monaco or Deportivo La Coruña that could put up together properly competitive teams with stars in a way that seems impossible now. And it feels like we're developing into a situation where that's going to even be more and more limited.
Mm. So Machiavellian. Let's accelerate the football inflation going on and then there'll only be one or two of us left. I mean, it's brutal. What about financial fair play? Texted in absolutely nobody in response to that point. Dear, oh dear. Miguel Delaney, always brilliant having you on. Thanks so much of the London Independent. Cheers, Miguel.
Cheers, Joe. Thanks again.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Yes, you're welcome, Max. So for Liverpool, there is relief after, well, over an hour of dominating the game and still having that nagging sense that they hadn't actually managed to score against Leipzig, and a Leipzig goal would make things very jittery. But they have scored twice, just like buses, in the space of a couple of minutes. Salah on 70 minutes. Jota did very well. He's had a good game, Jota. He's had an impact on Liverpool going forward this evening, and he set up Salah on 70 minutes, who finished well. 4 minutes later, Mane has put Liverpool 2-0 up. That is 4-0 on aggregate, and for the first time in what feels like a long time, Jurgen Klopp's post-match interview will not be trying to explain what went wrong once again. As for events over in Paris, in Parc des Princes, it's still 1-1 between PSG and Barcelona. Mbappe opened the scoring. Messi scored a wonderful goal from about 30 yards, flashed his left foot across the ball, and it swerved from right to left into the top corner. Brilliant goal. He did subsequently miss a penalty, but really, this game was killed in the first leg. So it's PSG 5-2 up on aggregate. And football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Now, to Spurs. The North London Derby is live on Off the Ball this Sunday. Spurs are a curious case. Great start of the season. Jose working his magic was the sense. And then a very alarming dip. The worst run of Jose's managerial career. And now something of a resurgence last couple of games. Gareth Bale inspired. They have won their last three games. Before that alarming run I mentioned, they were beaten by West Ham, by Man City, by Everton in the FA Cup, by Chelsea. They lost to Brighton. Liverpool beat them 3-1 at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium that Thursday evening. The net result, where they are now seventh in the table. They're still 5 points off fourth, but with the game in hand, they're far from out of it. 7 points ahead of Arsenal going into the weekend. For more, we're joined by Martin Lipton, chief sports reporter with The Sun. Evening, Martin.
Good evening.
Great to have you with us. So that dip, you know, some way after the brilliant start before this resurgence of late, it really was a dip. You were starting to wonder what was going wrong here. And, you know, Jose, it was odd. He wasn't stirring it up with the owners. He wasn't taking it out in the players in the way he had done previously. He was being quite positive about the situation. I was almost wondering at a certain point, was it because he felt his stock was so low he couldn't lash out the way he might usually? It was a really worrying period for them.
Yeah, they were a mess. I mean, some of the performances were desperate in terms of the inertia, the lack of conviction, lack of quality throughout the team. I mean, it coincided, of course, with the injury to Kane as well, which didn't help. But they were just, they were a sorry mess, really, for a while. And I think it needed a spark, and that spark came in a defeat, bizarrely, which was the performance of Gareth Bale off the bench at West Ham. Because although they lost the game, they could have scored 6, 7, 8. I mean, they really played very well in the second half, having been dreadful in the first half. It was like a different team, and Bale was the spark to that. And ever since then, you've seen a quantifiable improvement over the last few games, and they're playing with a lot more joy, belief, intensity going forward, as they were right at the start of the season.
Bale now has 6 goals in 6 games, and before that it was 4 goals in 16. He played a couple of Europa League games for a lot of the season. He wasn't playing much in the Premier League. I watched him start a game, I think it was away to Ludogorets in the Europa League. And genuinely, such was his body language, such was what felt like a lack of interest, a lack of confidence in his body. His touch was off, everything was rusty. I mean, I really did come away that night thinking it's over. It's done here. Whatever was there and what was so wonderful is over. And yet here he is.
I think the phrase I would use for Gareth Bale is that he's, and it's not a criticism, by the way, but he's mentally Dutch. In that, like all the Dutch players, unless he feels 100% safe, in confident in his body, he doesn't feel secure. He doesn't want to take risks. He's worried about breaking down. This is off the back of, not playing properly for quite some period of time. So he didn't have that game mentality for the last 18 months or so, really, at Real Madrid. And I think that showed as well. And he didn't trust himself. And it's taken a lot longer than I think he anticipated, and certainly Mourinho anticipated, for him to come to the level of which he is now. I think there was an expectation he would find this level from Spurs, and certainly a hope that he would, but they thought it would come quicker. And there was definitely a point where I think everyone was of the view that it's not going to happen. And then suddenly it has. And you watch him on Sunday, irrespective of the opposition, look at the way he's passing the ball. Look at the way he's demanding the ball. And look at the way that he's drawing defenders to him. Because, of course, if they have to cover Bale as well as Son and Kane, and now Moura, who's playing extremely well in that 10 role, they can't. You can't cover all of those players all the time. Someone's going to be free.
And Mourinho has made the point, for that very reason, the point you make about Kane and Son and Moura, and now if you add Bale into the mix, it's impossible to cover everyone. Mourinho has said, we don't need Gareth Bale to be the Bale of 5 years ago. We just need him to be a very, very decent version of himself, and that will be transformative. And I mean, it will, because the Kane-Son double act was, for a large part of the season, just that. I mean, they were pretty much, over to you two guys, we'll sit behind here and hope you do the rest.
Yeah, I mean, it was frighteningly reliant. I mean, they were lucky that they're such great players, and they are really top, top players. I don't think anyone would argue about Kane's ability or Son's. There isn't a team in the Premier League that those two couldn't get in. That's how good they are. Fully not a team in Europe they couldn't get in truth. So they were carrying the side in for the first few months. And eventually, that they stopped scoring with every chance and others didn't come to the party. And then injuries as well. And to be fair to Son, he isn't actually his best at the moment. He was much sharper at the start of the season. But it was almost as if he needed just something to go for him. And that the creating the chance for Kane in the last 10 minutes on Sunday may be what he needed as well, just to get out of that little rut that he's been in. They were reliant on them, no question. And they still need them. They're still critical and key, because Kane is such an important player because of what he brings to the party, what is his sheer talent. And his passing ability as well as his goals. But if you've got Bale as well, it does change the dynamic for the opponents.
Massively. And what you're saying about Bale and his body tallies exactly with what Jose Mourinho said. So Mourinho was saying after the weekend, with Gareth, we found psychological scars. When you have a couple of seasons with lots of injuries, I think it's not about the muscular scars, but the psychological scars. That brings fear, brings instability. There was a moment where that psychological barrier has to be broken, and he broke it. It was all him, not us, which is pretty gracious as well. So now that he's broken the barrier, the hope is he continues to keep on going and his body doesn't let him down. And that remains the question mark. We're now into the territory where he's feeling confident enough to hurt himself, in effect, you know, and to sprint and do all these things. And now you're just hoping his body doesn't let him down. And that's the $100 million question.
Well, it was interesting that he was taken off with 20 minutes to go, or even more, actually, on Sunday. This is Mourinho trying to manage his minutes. I would actually be surprised if Bale starts tomorrow night against Zagreb. I think he'll play him against Arsenal instead. Or if he starts tomorrow night, he probably doesn't start against Arsenal. Because you've still got Dele. You know he still likes Bergwijn, who can't score a goal, hasn't scored a goal all season. So they aren't forced to play Bale every game in a way that they might have been at some point. The way they are still forced to play Kane pretty much every game until the game's dead. And then if they're five up with 20 minutes to go, you can bring on Vinicius. But basically, you keep Kane on for as long as you can or as long as you need him because he's so important. I think with Bale, he'll be a little bit more cautious for Bale's sake, just to make sure that he doesn't overexert himself. I also remember that, you know, Bale's desperation to go to the Euros with Wales is a critical part of it as well. He knows he's the linchpin for that team still and wants to be there for his country. He can only be that if he's right. And now he's right.
There was some pretty explosive TV. I think most people saw it a couple of weeks ago when Roy Keane and Jamie Redknapp had an exchange of views on just how much talent Jose had at his disposal. Kane and Son aside, Roy wasn't seen very much. I think he eventually conceded Reguilon. He's a good player as well, but after much pushing from Jamie. So where are you on the talent Jose has at his disposal in this squad?
I think if they finish in the top four, given the season that's gone on, and it would actually be quite a good managerial feat. If he can then add that by winning the League Cup and winning the Europa League, he'll have to be judged a success, a significant success in this season. That's taken into account the fact that it is the oddest of odd seasons and every team has had bizarre blips that you couldn't have imagined happening before the season started. I look at that team and I see the strengths up front. You know, those front three, the way Moura is playing, as I said, and Ndombele playing well, and to a degree, Højbjerg and Reguilon. But then I look at centre-halves, right-back, goalkeeper, and I don't see a top-four team. You know, that's a mid-table collection for a variety of reasons. Alderweireld isn't the ability, it's the age factor, the fact that he's got old. Dyer has good games and bad games, but at the moment, more bad games than good games. Sanchez has actually played, by his standards, relatively well in the last couple of weeks, but you know there's an almighty blunder coming your way soon because that's the nature of the way he tends to play. He hasn't really got enough faith in Rodon yet. Tanganga's injury prone. Doherty, as I said last time I was on, hasn't worked this season. I don't think anyone can pretend he has. It's been disappointing. I think everybody at Tottenham expected far more than he's shown. Aurier is at times a significant liability, I'm afraid. And Lloris, while still not a bad goalkeeper, does make errors. The good thing about Lloris making errors is he doesn't worry about them because he's old enough to accept that they come. But he tends to have a rush of, you know, three or four games where he makes a collection of errors and then settles down, and Spurs will hope that he's gone back into his settling down period now. But he, you know, there are limitations there in that squad, unquestionably.
The Matt Doherty situation is obviously of interest to us, not least with Seamus Coleman's injury. I mean, we went from having two very good right backs with the World Cup qualifiers coming up now to not being quite sure what we have. We're hoping Coleman recovers. He's been in good form. The Doherty thing has been such a disappointment because he was so brilliant for a couple of years for Wolves and eye-catching, often against Spurs as well. And he's gone from looking very confident and full of conviction on the ball to having none of that on the ball, which is really odd to see for such a, you know, a player who was so good going forward. And then obviously in defence, and he's admitted as much himself, adjusting to being a right back in a flat back four as opposed to a wing back has been tricky for him. I mean, the night where they lost 3-1 to Liverpool, and he was really caught out and looked shaky. And I think a few times you could lip read Jose screaming Matt after a few of the goals. you're kind of worried, would he get back in? I know he played against Palace, but it's now at a stage where, you know, if the Cup final was on tomorrow, Aurier, Doherty, you're flicking a coin territory.
Or you're throwing Tanganga in instead if he's fit.
Yeah.
You're not sold on any of them, are you? Let's be honest.
No.
The one thing I think you can guarantee is that Tottenham, if they have any money at all, will spend it on a right back this summer.
Mm.
And a centre half, in truth. They're going to have to. You might keep Doherty as he's younger than Aurier and fully more committed as your second choice, but you're not going to keep them both next season. Not a chance. Not if you have any genuine hope of competing at the very highest level. Doherty may come back, may yeah. find his form, maybe, but at the moment, he's a million miles off. Not only what was expected, but also what he needs to be, in truth.
Mm. And is it just a simple case of adjusting from right wing back to right back in a back four? Have you heard anything through the grapevine at the club?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it's not that difficult, is it?
I wouldn't have thought it would have taken 4 or 5 months, no.
No, I mean, there comes a point where it's down to the player. And it may be there's other factors about which we don't know.
Mm.
It may, you know, I've no idea what happened in terms of his home life, how settled that might be. You know, we've all living through this incredible, unprecedented situation. There may be factors in the background about which we simply do not know that mean he's not felt comfortable in his own skin at the moment. So, you know, I don't want to write anybody off. It's just that what we've seen on the pitch isn't what would have been expected. And even if there is, you know, a while to get used to a different way of playing in a different formation, in a different team, under a different manager with different teammates, he's a professional footballer, he's a defender. There comes a point when it is down to him to sort it out.
Mm. Well, we're hoping that happens pretty soon. As for Jose himself, I mentioned when things were really not going well, he wasn't stirring the pot, he wasn't waging war on the owners or bemoaning his lack of resources, he wasn't making an example of a Luke Shaw type. He was pretty positive, I thought. Your sense of where he is in his career? Because at United, it was toxic. And, well, as you know from Chelsea and beyond, it's been toxic plenty of the time previously. Less so, I would say, at the moment.
I said all the way through, I've been amazed at how well he's been behaved, because I didn't expect that. Particularly when if you look back to this time last year when they were all those injuries and couldn't buy a win either, and were pretty ropey, in fact, worse in some ways than they have been this season. Even then, he wasn't moaning. He wasn't complaining. He wasn't blaming everybody else. He was taking responsibility, and he's done that now. Yeah, there's been times when he said, "What can I do about defenders who can't defend?" And to be honest, he's got a fair point when simple, soft goals are being conceded, when the centre-half gives the ball away inside his own box or stupidly decides to foul a player who's going nowhere, as Dyer did to Werner. That's just exasperation, frustration to an act of stupidity on the pitch. But in terms of his general demeanour, behaviour, language, he's been extremely good.
Yeah.
Not just by his standards, actually, by the standards of many, you know. Look at the way how surly Klopp has been in recent weeks. Mourinho's under significantly more pressure. You know, people aren't writing about Klopp could be the next one sacked. It's always Mourinho could be the next one sacked, when the results were pretty similar. He gets more scrutiny because of what's happened in the past, I think, to a degree. And obviously, Klopp deserves latitude because of what Liverpool did last season. So I'm not being critical at all of Klopp. But I have seen a different Mourinho, and I thought we might get a different version. I just feared that we might revert back to the dark Mourinho. I mean, I remember speaking to him in Milan in about the October of 19. There was the FIFA Player of the Year World Best Award thing. And
to give it its official
title. He came
title.
Out of La Scala, and I had just a brief chat with him. But you could see the shine was back in his eyes. I could see, just, you know, I've known him ever since he came to England in 2004. And you could tell he was ready. He wanted to come back. And you think, OK, that's great. And when he came back at the Spurs, he was all smiles and everything else. You normally expect that to fade and die and disappear and the devil on his shoulder to start whispering in his ear.
it may well be whispering in his ear, but he appears to be not listening.
Mm.
And that's a change from what we've seen time and again. Even when he was on the crest of a wave at Chelsea and Inter, in that period of his most successful period of his career, there was always the Machiavellian nastiness that was lurking around. We haven't really seen that at Tottenham.
No. Long may it continue. Martin Lipton, Chief Sports Reporter with The Sun. Thanks so much, Martin.
Cheers. Take care. Good night.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network.